welcome to the Unbothered Moms. We are shifting our perspectives and
letting shit go.
I'm Bridget.
I'm Kat.
And today we have a special guest with us. We have Dr. Farah, who graduated medical school in 2016 and has been a practicing OBGYN ever since. So we have her here today to answer some questions about women's health. Thanks for coming, Farah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course.
We're excited.
We are excited. And I think our viewers are going to be excited too. So we have a couple questions for you.
Okay.
In no particular order, but wanted to just kind of get your viewpoints and opinions on these kind of burning questions in our minds and then also our listeners' minds.
Awesome.
Let me say real quick. Women's health is something that's like obviously super important, but it's not talked about enough.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of us saying, hey, it's okay to talk about it, and we're super appreciative for you to be so open about it. We hope discussions like this happen more often, amongst people in general, but women specifically. And you know, with us raising daughters, it's really important to have that in mind and make sure that we're talking about these things. So we appreciate that, and we hope to shed some light on women's bodies.
Everyone, the mystery of a woman's body.
No one wants to talk about it or think about it, but no one talks about it. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
Right, your turn.
So first and foremost, how can we proactively balance our pH levels?
That's a good question. And that's actually a question I see a lot of women about, whether they talk about like their annual or they come in for problems. So it's actually pretty easy in the sense that you actually don't have to do anything technically. The less you do, the better, actually. Now, I know there are tons of products, right, that are marketed over like for washes and deodorant and like all that stuff. And there are some women who can use them and it doesn't do anything and they like it and it's great and that's fantastic. But for the majority of women, it's going to cause you problems.
Why is that?
Well, so really the vagina and the vulva area. I'm going to use technical terms, by the way,
because
I think it's important that women know the right words to use to describe the areas, because I can't tell you how many times people tell me they have vaginal issues and it's actually vulvar issues. And you approach them very differently. But anyway, issues in those areas, I mean, outside of like sweat and stuff, like a lot of women, especially in the summers and stuff, sweat causes a lot of irritation and everything. But outside of that kind of gentle washing to like rid yourself of sweat, you don't have to do anything more. You technically don't even have to use soap down there. They actually, for people who have lots of issues, they really just recommend rinsing well with warm water. If you do use a soap, we usually tell people like unscented stuff. So like Dove or Aveeno or like stuff that's like pretty sensitive and like no fragrances. Again, there are some people who can use whatever body wash they want to use down there and it doesn't cause them any issues. And if that's your, that's how you are, then fantastic. Don't change anything. But for people, especially for women who tend to get recurrent infections, really, like I always tell them, like, you got to start backing off, like take out one thing at a time and you're like, whatever you're doing. Because it really can cause more irritation, or you can start using those washes and you think everything's fine and then you run out and you don't get more. And then you, that's when you notice you actually have dryness or irritation or itching. And it's, you think it's because you're not using the wash that all of a sudden your pH is off. And it's actually because your pH has been off and you need to give time. You need to give time to restore it. So I always tell people less is more. Again, if you're someone that likes those washes and you know, you find you're off of it and you're still fine, then great. You know what? If you want to use it, you can. I don't think it's doing anything for you, but if it makes you feel better, then fine. But if you're having problems, then that's usually what I actually talk to people about, because I think it's really, I don't, we're marketed these things and you think you need it. And, you know, and you hear it from guys sometimes too, that it smells down there and stuff. And it's like, it has a smell. Okay.
Right.
Not to be TMI, dicks have smells too.
Yeah.
I love that.
You also smell.
It's not like, I mean, listen, if it's a very, very unpleasant smell and like you can smell it, then like that might be something's wrong and you should definitely go see your doctor.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It can smell very fishy and stuff. But for the most part, and like I have so many women come in and be like, it just always smells down there. And like I'm literally facing it and I'm like, it doesn't really smell like bad. It's not bad.
This is going to be our clip. That's so good.
Face in it.
But that's why, like, it's annoying. And I say, like, you're a douche if if you're douching. Like, you're like, it's the problem.
That's the worst thing you can do, honestly.
It's the worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
It just fucks it up completely.
It does. And there's a lot of these, like, you'll see these things online and stuff, like, use apple cider vinegar if you think you have a yeast infection. Like, that'll restore your pH. Please don't put vinegar in your vagina.
I mean, I have a question.
It's very old school. And, you know, and again, some people doesn't bother them.
It burns.
It probably does.
They come in and says it burns. And I'm like,
I'm like, you literally put vinegar in your hoo-ha.
Yeah.
I do have a question. You touched on yeast. So, like, I am a yeast queen. Mm-hmm. Only because, like, when I'm on antibiotics every time.
Yeah.
Like, every time. Mm-hmm. So, just recently, and I don't know if I messed it up, but I did boric acid. Mm-hmm. Depository,
yeah,
in conjunction with a women's probiotic while I took my, and like I didn't get a yeast infection and it felt okay, So, like, what do you think about boric acid suppositories?
Yeah, so it is something I recommend for people who get like very recurrent infections. You really have to be careful, and probiotics too. Probiotics, there's mixed data, right? Like, and taking an oral probiotic is there's really no proof that it's going to help your vaginal health, because like the bacteria is not getting there from, it's not going in your bloodstream. That's not how it works.
Yep.
There are vaginal probiotics, so like vaginal suppositories you can insert. Again, the data is somewhat mixed. I usually tell people who are like you, Kat, who get recurrent infections, it doesn't hurt to try. It's not, you know what I mean? It's not going to hurt what already is a problem for you.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think that's sometimes what people do, like once a week or twice a week, even depending on how they are. And then boric acid is great. So the vaginal pH is meant to be slightly more acidic. It's not like our blood and stuff. It's meant to be at a pH of like 4, 4.5. So acid, boric acid, helps to maintain that, helps to maintain that acidity that the vagina is supposed to have. So that's how it works. So in your case, all women have yeast in their vaginas. It is a colonizer of the vagina. But what happens? Oh, sorry. My whole setup just fell.
That was great.
The whole thing just fell. All right. We're going to just have to, going to have to hold it. But So the yeast is a natural colonizer of the vagina, but what happens when the pH is off is that the yeast can grow. Not as much as bacterial vaginosis, which is BV, what you were saying before, but some women get excess yeast and it causes symptoms. So it's one way to try to prevent that alteration of the pH is, boric acid is a great option for people. Yeah. It's not something you should use every day. I think in this, how you used it, whereas like, you know, you get this, that's how I tell people, like, try to use it as more preventative. Like, I have some women who get a lot of infections after they have sex. So I tell them, you know, give yourself like a day, the next day, use a boric acid suppository. Like, don't put it in right away because it's going to burn. But like the next day, it's not a bad idea to try. The one thing I always caution people, not that many people are going to be doing this, but boric acid is actually toxic orally to humans. So you really obviously don't take it orally. It's meant to go in the vagina, and like, you cannot engage in oral sex if you've just used it. The day before is fine. It's like, don't put it in and then an hour later have sex. Like, that's not how you should do it.
Wait. So if hypothetically speaking, a woman takes a lot of boric acid, a guy can't go down there because he might die.
Well, it's not like die, but it's not good to be. It's really not good to be ingested. So it shouldn't be like, you shouldn't put it in and then like have sex after.
Right.
But if you put it in the night before and then the next day, like at that point, you should be fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. It's not like on the labels.
She's literally like, well, if I ever have a lover, I don't think.
I've never used boric acid in my life.
I research because I had strep throat. I had antibiotics for 10 days and I just felt things getting a little funny. And I'm like, come on, man. Every time I get a yeast infection.
Yeah.
And guess what? I didn't get one.
Yeah. If it works,
I did my research.
Works, and that's went and totally fine. Acid. It doesn't work for everyone, but it definitely is something that can, it can help for sure.
Okay, great.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What's our next question? Thank you.
Next
That's
question.
So great.
I'm like, so excited. So what is the most effective birth control? And do not say abstinence.
No, that's not a birth control, right? Because if you're doing it, if you're abstinent, you're not trying to prevent pregnancy.
Right.
Technically. So.
Technically, yeah. Okay, fair enough.
Anyway. But yes, okay, yes, technically. So, there's two different ways to look at birth controls. There's perfect use and typical use. We did Team PEP. You should remember. We talked about this stuff, right? I will say Team PEP probably side note, it was like a sexual health thing that we had in our high school where we were in high school and we would go teach seventh and eighth graders about like different skits and stuff about sexual health. And I actually think that really inspired me to go to OBGYN. I loved our teen pep class.
I love teen pep too. I think I learned a lot, like a lot of what I learned about STDs and things like that, like stuck with me.
Then I went and taught other people anyway. So just a side note, I think that's something that probably actually stuck with me that I ended up helped me lead me to this place where I'm at now. But anyway, so for effective birth control. So the most effective birth controls are going to be ones where you really don't have to do much for them to work, if that makes sense. So IUDs and something called the Nexplanon, which is an arm implant. I don't know if you've seen them. They're like this big and they get inserted into the arm. Those are the most effective forms. The Nexplanon technically in studies is the most effective. It has a 0.05% chance of pregnancy.
What did you say?
0.05. Nexplanon. The arm one. Yeah, the arm implant. Yeah. It works pretty similarly to the IUD. I think part of the, I mean, studies were slightly different, but I think part of the reason is like there's less of a chance of it migrating and moving. Like it just gets stuck under into the fat under the arm and that's how it works. IUDs are probably the next, and depending which IUD, they're both less than 1%. Well, all of them are less than 1%. I'm personally biased. I love an IUD. I think most women, a lot of women don't do well on IUDs, and I totally recognize that, but I think more people would do better. I think there's a, people get stuck in their heads about IUDs a little bit, which I get. It's something that's sitting inside your body, and that aspect for some women is just like, I can't, they can't deal with it. They just think about it, right? They can't feel it. They don't know it's there, but they think it's, they can think they can feel it. And that's fine. Not, it's not for everyone, but it's a really great option. I think it's actually a really great option for young girls. So that's my little caveat on IUDs, but IUDs are also one of the most effective. Next, it comes to like calling up all the other ones that most people know, birth control pills. Birth control pills, if taken correctly, can be like 90 to 99% effective. But for people, a lot of people skip pills, they forget about it. It's something you have to do every single day, which is why its typical use is only like, I think it's like 93, 94% or something like, which is still good. I mean, it's still really good, but it's not 100, you know?
And that's how you get Izzy, girl.
And that's how you get Izzy. And then other things like the birth control pill. So there are hundreds of different types of birth control pills. All of their efficacy is pretty much the same. The NuvaRing, which I don't know if you guys heard about, it's like those small or clear flexible rings that goes in the vagina. That's about the same efficacy as a birth control because it's pretty much the same thing. It's just a different route of delivery. Condoms are good when used correctly and the correct size.
Well, how do you know if it's a good size or not?
The vast, vast majority of men are the average size, like the,
of what?
Of condoms. Like, I actually, so like, I'll be honest, I've not used a condom in years.
When
so,
they're just average.
Right. Like, you can probably just get your regular standard box of condoms, and that should fit the vast, vast majority of guys. I kind of think it's, I mean, you should obviously be proactive, but I kind of think the guy, if he knows that he doesn't fit comfortably in a like a normal size condom that the average person would have, then he maybe should carry the larger condoms on him, you know, if he knows. But then again, I feel like some people are like, yeah, I wear that bigger size. And like you see it on them. And if there's like too much space at the top or something, or it's rolled too much
or
at the bottom.
It's falling off.
Yeah. Then like that's not,
no,
that's not
you,
dude.
It should not be falling off.
I know that.
It shouldn't be loose. It really shouldn't be loose. It shouldn't be tight either, but it shouldn't like, it shouldn't look like a tube sock on it. Like, you know?
Literally.
So, I can't. I'm dead.
Yeah. And then there are tons of other types of birth controls, but I feel like the ones we mentioned are the ones I see the vast, vast majority of people use. Now, in terms of like non-hormone birth controls, because there are options for that, the people do like the body temperature or they just track their cycle.
That's what I'm doing right
now. Or they pull out or they do a combination of those things. It really depends on the person. And like, I don't think I can really quote a stat for you. Like the average is somewhere in like the high 80s, but there are some women who like know their cycle. They're very regular. They can tell when they're about to ovulate. You know, they track all those signs, which we'll talk about later. And yeah, and they can, they know when to avoid it or what to do to, you know, not get pregnant. And it works great for them. And people do that for years. And that's totally fine. If that works for you, that's totally fine. I do think for some women who are super busy, who maybe aren't the best at regularly tracking or don't have regular cycles to begin with, those types of methods are going to be a little less effective for you. And I always tell people, if that's what you want to do, it's fine. Understand that your risk of pregnancy is a little higher than if you were on something else. And as long as you're okay with that, then, you know, it's your life. You can do what you want to do. So
I will say I am. So I was on birth control forever. Mm-hmm. And this is like into our next kind of question, mm-hmm. like coming off of being on birth control forever. So I was on it since I was like 18. Mm-hmm. Got off, had a kid, got back on it, had a kid. Like, and then I finally got an IUD, remember? Mm-hmm. I had so many problems with the IUD. Yeah. I'm telling you, I got it in, back pain, cramps, like everything for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then finally, because my doctor's like, wait 6 months, let's see if you. And then I went in, I was like, take this out.
Yeah.
Please. Took it out. All my symptoms were gone.
Yeah.
So like I liked the idea of the IUD. I was like, hell yeah, put it in there. I don't have to worry about anything.
Yeah.
It did not like me.
Yeah.
And maybe there was another one that could, I don't know. I didn't want to chance it.
No.
It was terrible.
It's not great to get put in either, like, not going to lie.
Oh, it hurts so. I wasn't expecting that. I remember I walked out and I was like, I feel so violated.
It hurts like a minute.
It's just not good.
Yeah.
I don't know. So now I'm on Natural Cycles, mm-hmm. the app, mm-hmm. with, and it's measuring my temperature every day.
Yeah.
So I'm learning, though, my cycle.
Yeah.
I was never good with that because I was on a freaking birth control pill. Yeah. I never had to know my cycle. Mm-hmm. I didn't know when I was ovulating. Mm-hmm. I didn't know shit.
Yeah.
I just woke up every day and was like, little pill, hi.
And when you're on a pill, if you're not trying to get pregnant, like, that's okay. But mm-hmm. for some people, some people want to know their cycle more and stuff like that and, like, know what to expect for themselves. And I will also say it does change as you get older. Like, I have some, like, the reason a lot of young women, honestly, the reason I started a lot of teenagers or, like, older teens or early adult, young adults who want to go on birth control is because, like, their periods suck. They are super crampy. They're bleeding too much. It's super irregular. And they want to live their life. And, you know, being protected from pregnancy isn't, like, a bad thing for them. So birth control works great for some people. But I do mm-hmm. have a lot of patients that, yeah, like you, Kat, like, after you're, you know, maybe done having kids, yeah, you can go back on it. And if you're really where I have some people are, like, terrified to get pregnant again. And they're like, please give me something. And that's fine. I get it. You don't want to get pregnant. But I do find a lot of old, like, women in their 30s and 40s, once they're done having kids, like, that's when they're like, you know what, I was on it for a while, I want to take a break. And that's fine. And then they start tracking their cycles. And some people, it's like, oh, it's not that bad. And that's great. And then there are other women who are like, this is terrible. Like, why was I this is why I didn't get it for so many years. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then we go back on something. So it depends on the person.
Are there any repercussions for being on birth control for 10 plus years?
No, there's more data coming out. Okay.
Okay.
I will say, in terms of your fertility, absolutely not. That is a very common misconception I think a lot of women have, that being on birth control, especially like all through your 20s and like you get off of it and then you can't get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
It's more coincidence than anything else, because our prime reproductive years are in our early to mid 20s, honestly.
Right.
Like, you know, you can complain about the patriarchy and all that stuff, but just biologically, that's mm-hmm. our peak reproductive time. There are plenty of women who get pregnant in their 30s and 40s and are totally fine. There are women in their 20s that have fertility issues. But technically, you know, a lot of women our age, I think we're on birth control for a very long time, stopped it to try to get pregnant, and then they can't get pregnant. And then you can't help but think, oh my God, did I break my body by taking this pill for 10 years? You did not break your body. You did not do anything wrong. There actually are some benefits that they are finding for taking birth control. A lot of these studies are for the pill specifically. So people who did the IUD and stuff, I can't directly compare it, but they actually found decreased risk for ovarian cancer, decreased risk for colorectal cancer and uterine cancer, actually. There's some questionable increased risk about breast cancer for prolonged mm-hmm. use. There are some studies that suggest it. There are others that say it's not as much of a risk. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where the data is still a little mixed. But if you were taking the pill because you didn't want to get pregnant or it was helping with your period and stuff, you did nothing wrong by taking it for an extended period of time. If it helped you live your life and do what you need to do, like, that was the purpose of the pill. Honestly, it's what got women in the workforce. It's what got women to be able to control when they had kids. And I feel like the pill, you know, when it came out in the 60s or whatever, it's one of the biggest things that led to, you know, us being able to be where we're at now. essentially.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. This is like a feel-good woman moment.
So you did nothing wrong by taking it, because the original purpose was, you know, not the original purpose, but one of the benefits of the pill is being exactly where, you know, most of us are at right now.
Right.
Like, does it bother our brains? I've seen things. Some
people,
I know.
Some people. Yeah. There was a study, I think, that came out like a few years. Oh, my God. No, I think I was in residency when it came out, that showed it can increase the risk of like depression in some women. But then there have been studies that show it doesn't have as much of an effect. Like, literally, you can find a study that shows your point of view. The point is the quality of these studies. And, you know, but I definitely have people that say it affects their mood. Now, for some women, it actually improves their mood. If they have really bad, like PMS or PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorders, like really bad mood symptoms, especially associated with your period, one of the treatments is trying a birth control pill. Yeah. Because you really, what happens, it's a result of the fluctuations of the hormones that naturally occurs with the cycle. And by taking a birth control pill, people are like, oh, but you're taking a hormone. But it's a steady state of hormones. It's the same amount every single day versus the highs and lows that typically happen. And that can help to regulate a little bit better for some women. But there are some women that, I mean, it's definitely a risk. It's on the box if you read it, that there's a risk of depression, like suicide risk, stuff like that. So it's not, there are obviously risks and it doesn't work for everyone. Yeah. I think the vast majority of people can find a pill that works for them. It's not always the first pill you try, or even a birth control method, a hormonal birth control method. There are definitely people who cannot take it for various reasons. And that's fine. And we find something else. But I think that there's a lot of talk. A lot of the visits I see, and like for young girls or young women who are worried about starting birth control, is they see a lot of these misconceptions and misinformation on like TikTok and Instagram and social media about how like they don't need it, how it's just going to ruin their bodies and stuff. And I think that's really a disservice for women, because that's like, just because you had an issue with, like, Kat, you had an issue with the IUD. Mm-hmm. Me and Bridget have an IUD and we love it. I'm on my third one. Yes. Like, it's great.
Yeah.
We're big fans. Yeah.
So like,
and I say that to people. Yeah. I'm super open. I'm like, hey, whatever works for you. Yeah. Like, it did not work for me. Exactly. Like, trust your body. But go, then I went back on the pill, like, until I got off completely. You know what I mean? Like, do whatever works for you.
Exactly. So I don't think, if you had a problem with it, like, you should definitely like voice those concerns you have. But actively dissuading people from doing something that's going to possibly help them, it's a pet peeve. It's a frustrating part of my, I love my job. But I spend a good portion of my job like trying to convince these people, and I feel like there are benefits to it. And don't trust, just because someone had a bad experience does not mean that's going to happen to you.
Preach. I love that. That's with anything in life, not to go on a tangent.
Oh, 100%. But,
right? Like, okay, next question. When should women get fertility testing if they are planning to have a family?
The short answer is when you are close to the point of trying to actually get pregnant. Because if you're in your early 20s, here's the caveat. If you are going to do something about it, that's what I actually tell people. So like I've had some young women that come in and want fertility testing. I tell them like, are you going to try to get pregnant in the next year or two? Or if you did this, would you consider egg freezing or something depending on the result? Mm-hmm. And some of them are like, yes. You know, like, yes, if you tell me like something is wrong, then, you know, then we can do it. So I'll do it. But for some women, especially in their early 20s or mid 20s that want fertility testing, and they're like, well, I'm not going to try to get pregnant for 10 years. I could do it and I can give you the information, but that doesn't mean that's going to be relevant for when you're actually trying to get pregnant. You know what I mean? I think that's the key. So like if you, like I've had some people that get it and I'm like, you know, this, your counts maybe aren't the best. Like you might end up having some trouble. And I have someone like, okay, I'm going to go see a fertility specialist and like do a consult. And some of them have gone on to do egg freezing because they had, you know, the fertility person said, you know, I think you're going to have low counts. Like, you know, you might want to do this now. Cause if you aren't planning on getting pregnant for the next couple of years, at least it's just going to get worse. Right. So I think that's the key. It's like, are you going to do something about the information? Because I can do it and I can tell you everything's fine and you try to get pregnant in 5-6 years from then and you don't get pregnant, like things change and it can change that quickly. So yeah, I think for specific reasons, I think it can be beneficial.
Do you see like an uptick with, I feel, and maybe it's just because I'm older and I'm like, realizing certain things? Do you see an uptick in people, like, instead of just trying, like, naturally for a little bit of time, mm-hmm. like, everyone's in this panic of, like...
A lot of people are in a panic.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, what is going on with that? I feel like I know a lot of people doing, like, IVF and this stuff before they even really know if anything's happening. Yeah. And I'm like, wait, did you... Like, maybe you just need to relax a little bit and let your body just get banged out.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's true.
But it's like stress when you're worried 100%. About it. It makes it so much harder.
100%.
So it's like, just have some good sex.
Yeah.
Stop worrying. Give it a little bit of time and then go through the process if you have a problem. Yeah. But I feel like people are so like, do it now. I'm scared. IVF.
I think that comes a lot from like, I think a lot of people our generation have like control stuff. Like, you want control, you know? Mm-hmm. You do. I see it with pregnancy too. Like, you want control over something that you really don't have that much control about. You know, I've had some where I practice, I have a mix of patients. I do have some very affluent patients who say, like, okay, well, I'm going to try to get pregnant for my first one on my own, but when I'm ready to have my second or third one, I'm worried I'm going to be too old. So I'm going to do IVF now, save some embryos so I have them for later if I need it, which is like, you have that flexibility and want to go through that whole process, that's nice. Like, good for you. IVF is no joke. It's a lot of shots and needle, especially for the woman. Like, the guy just shows up the day of and like jerks off into a cup and like that's his contribution. For the woman, the woman, it's like weeks of shots and ultrasounds and blood work, like every day or every other day or something. It's insane how much. And then you have to get like, it's a minor procedure, but still surgery that they have to go in and collect the eggs and stuff. It's not for the faint of heart. It's a process, and most women have to do it at least a couple times to get like the amount of eggs you need. It depends on how well you respond to it. So it's not easy. And I would not tell people to jump right to IVF unless you know you need it for a certain reason. But I do think that there's, you know, you hear people get pregnant right away, right? And you think that's the norm. And I think first off, if you're thinking of trying to get pregnant, I think one of the best things you can do for yourself is actually go try to see your OBGYN, because you should know whatever risks you have before you get pregnant to try to take some time to try to improve them as best you can. And
what do you mean by risks?
Like, people who maybe, you know, depending on your age, depending on your ethnicity, your background, any medical problems you have like going on. Like, I think a lot of those things you can, there are certain things you can at least be either mentally prepared for, or, you know, trying to exercise a little bit more before you get pregnant. Like, that in itself can increase your chances. There's no specific diets or exercise specifically that does it, but just taking care of yourself actually increases your chances. Some women worry about weight loss and stuff like that, or wanting to lose weight before getting pregnant. And I tell them, like, you don't need to go on Ozempic and like lose a bunch of weight. Like, it's really like 5% of your total body weight, which can be about like 10 pounds or something like that. And that alone can increase your chances of getting pregnant. You actually hear of all these like Ozempic babies now, like women lost weight on Ozempic and then they end up getting pregnant. And it's because just losing a little bit of weight for some women can be the thing that you need to actually get pregnant. So I think like having those types of discussions, you know, talking about prenatal vitamins, like what to expect in a pregnancy, all that stuff, I think is beneficial to talk about with your doctor before you get pregnant. But not everyone has that luxury, right? Things happen and that's fine. But I think that a lot of people have this like idea in their head, again, that they should get pregnant right away. If they don't get pregnant in the first couple months, something is absolutely wrong with them. And that's not necessarily the case. It does depend on your age. So, you know, I tell my patients, if you're 35 or older, 6 months is really what you should be trying before you should get concerned. And for if you're under 35 and you're otherwise healthy, and as far as you're aware, you have no other problems, then a year. Most people get pregnant in the first 6 months. Okay. But it takes like 85% of couples will get pregnant within 12 months of trying. And that's consistent trying. Like, every month you are, you know, when you're ovulating and you have sex to try to get pregnant.
Am I geriatric? I'm 36. Am I like considered a geriatric pregnancy if I were to get pregnant? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So, okay. There's two different.
Yes, you're old. I'm an old bitch.
So, yes.
Baby could still be making baby maker.
I will tell you that I use advanced maternal age because I think that's a slightly nicer way to word it.
What did you call it?
Advanced maternal age.
advanced maternal age. That sounds classy.
Yeah, versus elderly or geriatric. So, okay, technically, would you be in that category? Yes, you would. Like, if you're strictly asking about how I would bill it, that's how I have to bill it.
Let's talk about it. I'm 36.
Yeah, so 35 and older. But if you were 36, mm-hmm. like in your case, you had two kids, you had two otherwise pretty uncomplicated pregnancies, I'm not really worried about you. Like, I'm not. Okay. I'm going to be completely honest. Someone who's 35, 36 is much different than someone who's 40, than someone who's 45, than someone who's 50. The risk definitely is age dependent. 35 was used as the cutoff because that's when they find at least the risk of Down syndrome can start to increase. So that's where that arbitrary cutoff came from. And that's something I do tell people, if you're older, if you're over the age of 35, like, you do have a slightly increased risk of miscarriage and you have a slightly increased risk of having like a chromosomal genetic abnormality with the baby. So, and in that sense, there are some tests that actually all women get nowadays, but when the test first came out, you had to be advanced maternal age to qualify for it, to have it covered by insurance.
Got it.
Yeah. Nowadays, those tests are actually recommended for all pregnant women. So that doesn't really matter anymore, but that's how it kind of started.
Okay.
But, you know, as you get older in general, you risk for complications with pregnancy, increase risk for preeclampsia. So blood pressure issues with pregnancy, gestational diabetes, like a premature birth or something like that, like those risks can start to increase as you get older. It doesn't mean hard and fast 35, your risk is so much higher than if you got pregnant the year before. And a lot of that also plays a role, like your ethnicity, your general health as baseline, your family history, things like that play a role too. You being 36, if you got pregnant again, like, I'll be honest, I wouldn't bat an eye, because vast majority of patients I see nowadays, honestly, are in their 30s. Most first-time moms are in their 30s nowadays. I think the age is still, I think the most common age or the average age is still like late 20s, but the amount of first-time moms in their 30s has been increasing over like the past 10 years. And I would say in my practice, I think the vast majority of my patients are 30 and up. We delivered a 50-year-old last year with her second baby. It was a donor egg, but that's a whole separate issue. But she was still pregnant at 50.
Yeah,
she looked great on it. I mean, she looked older, but she looked great for 50, and she actually had a great pregnancy. So, you know,
all right,
it can happen.
I mean, I'm not trying for anymore. We are done. But I'm at advanced maternal.
You are at
advanced maternal. We're 34. If I get pregnant again, I'm going to be advanced maternal age. I mean,
you're going to be talking to yourself like, hey, you advanced maternal, motherfucker. We're going to deliver this baby.
We're going to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good, because I feel like there's this pressure.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm done regardless, but like, I have friends who are my age who have never had a baby, and they are just plagued with this unsurmounted pressure of being like, I have to have this baby now, which, guess what? Then you, like, one, if you don't have a partner, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah.
And two, if you do, the sex you're having is not fun, because you feel all this pressure and you're like, do me now.
Yeah.
I'm ovulating. Hurry up. It becomes a chore. Mm-hmm. You're putting your legs up. You're doing all these like things.
Yeah.
And it's like, when did we become a society who is so, like, I don't even know. Like, that's not what baby making is supposed to be. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know.
But there's all these pressures.
It is.
You know what I mean?
There
and
is.
Then now, and I feel like, you know, put money aside, like, people are taking out loans for IVF and like all these things.
Yes.
Because now it's like, well, if you have a problem, just come here. And it's like, wait. Try to just talk to your doctor first.
I think a lot of people
maybe you need some vitamins, you know?
Yes.
I don't know.
I think it's hard because we're constantly bombarded by like our own family, by society, by, you know, everywhere essentially, that like the longer you wait, the harder it's going to get. And unfortunately, there is truth to that, but it's not for everyone. Like, there are plenty of women in their late 30s or 40s that get pregnant on their own, and that's totally normal. The hard thing is, one, fertility testing isn't the best. Like, I can do testing to see, and for people who it's bad, it's obvious. But for people who comes out good or like okay, that really, I can't tell you how easy it's going to actually be for you to get pregnant. All I can tell you is it doesn't look bad. You might as well try, essentially. You know?
Yeah.
There's just so, even with fertility specialists, like, there's only so much testing we can do. And there's, you know, with experience and stuff, you can kind of maybe tell who might have issues and who wouldn't. But it happens all the time. I can't tell you how many patients I've had who, like, I give them a referral to go see the fertility specialist. It does take usually a couple months to get in. So I usually tell them to start ahead of time, like call ahead of time and get that appointment and just keep trying. And they go there and they're pregnant, you know, because they kind of took that pressure off. They're like, all right, we're going to go see the specialist. Well, they'll get this figured out.
Got it.
Then it just happens. Or, you know, people like, I'm going to take a break for a couple months. Like, you know, I just want to relax and stuff. And then they get pregnant. I'm not saying that tracking your ovulation and stuff is helpful. But I think some people really do it to the extreme, and you get in your head that the older you get, you're going to have issues. You're going to not have a good pregnancy and stuff. And the vast majority of people are honestly fine. They're totally fine. They have a really otherwise okay, normal pregnancy, and the birth is otherwise normal, like no major issues and stuff. But you don't know that until it happens. Right.
Yeah.
I was paranoid. I mean, you know, I'm an OBGYN, right? I know this. Sometimes too much knowledge is not super helpful. And there are studies that female physicians specifically have increased rates of fertility because of the training we do. Our circadian rhythms are like totally off. Like you live unhealthy lifestyles, essentially. There's this big study I remember in the New York Times that was published in the New York Times a couple of years ago that like literally said female physicians like almost always have problems getting pregnant. So in my head, I mentally prepared myself. I'm like, all right, I'm going to have problems. I'm going to take out my IUD at this time. We're going to do this. I bought the ovulation test. I was driving myself crazy. And we got pregnant the second month of trying. We used one ovulation stick. And my husband was like, you said this was going to take a long time. I was like, sorry.
You're like, gotcha.
It's like, I thought I had more time.
Yeah, he really did.
You're like,
nope. Like we were literally planning on having a baby in 2024 was like the idea. And like, we squeaked him in right at the end. He's amazing and we love him very much.
Yeah, but he's great.
When I took the pregnancy test, which I took it as a fluke, I was like, I wasn't even late yet. I was like, let me just like see it. I freaked out. Someone who reads a pregnancy test almost every single day, I was like, no, am I reading this right? Like, this isn't real. I Googled it. I was like, I'm making sure.
You're like, I need to make sure. Yeah. I've done this every day for years.
But suddenly I can't read my own test.
I'm confused.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So I think you just can't help but just create this narrative in your head that you are going to be the one that has problems and stuff like that. But the vast majority of people really, it really isn't that. Most people do just fine.
Yeah. Perfect.
I know we have some hormone questions, but like to ask you.
Yes.
Let's get into like a good one. A good one. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it sometimes that I'm more dischargy on certain days? Is that like with ovulation?
Yes. So like, especially since you're not on birth control or anything like that. Yeah. Your hormone fluctuation. So as I said, like you have hormone fluctuation throughout the cycle. The hormone fluctuations affect your discharge and the consistency of your discharge. So during ovulation, when you're trying to get, your body, obviously every month is trying to get pregnant. Technically, that's how it works.
Yep.
Cool.
Your discharge leading up to and up to ovulation can be much thinner. They used to describe it as like egg whites, like raw egg whites kind of consistency, but it is much thinner. And that's because it's thinner, the sperm can traverse it more easily and get you pregnant more easily. Yeah. So, and it changes. Totally normal. Especially if you're not on birth control, definitely you can see changes in your discharge throughout the month. If you are on birth control, you still can too.
Sometimes I'm like, why am I a little juicy today?
Yeah.
What's going on? Like, I'm just learning my body not being on birth control. So it's weird. Like, I'm like, ooh, like, and I'll feel it and I'll look at my app and I'm like, oh, it says I'm ovulating. And I kind of have like a cramp on one side.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, I've never felt my body like this.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what you don't know. I've never dealt with it.
When you're actually paying attention, like you can doubt. I mean, if you were just not tracking or anything like that, like some people wouldn't even think twice about it, right? You're like, oh, I'll pay for like a few, like maybe an hour, not even that, like sometimes shorter. And you're just like, oh, okay. And you think it's just your gut or something like that. Like, oh, maybe I ate something weird. But if you're actually tracking, sometimes you definitely know.
You know what I didn't know and I feel dumb?
What?
I didn't know that we release an egg from one side.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Isn't that what it is? I thought they both just are like.
They just race.
Shooting them out.
Race down the fallopian
tubes. That's what they do. They're both like, ready, go. Like,
oh, God.
How would I know? How would I know that one side releases?
Health class?
Okay, no.
I was looking at the cool picture of our fallopian tubes. I wasn't listening to what they were saying.
In cast defense, first off, health like classes in general are not the best. And how many of us are actually paying attention in fourth grade when they're teaching this stuff, or fifth grade or sixth grade, you know?
Yeah.
They don't really, when in high school, when you like actually maybe sort of might pay attention, they mostly just focus on sex. I don't ever remember them teaching us like how the female body works, like how a period works and stuff like that. Yeah, I don't remember that. And if you don't have that discussion with your child, then how would they're going to learn it from their, they're going to learn stuff from their friends. And that's like,
right. Or TikTok or Instagram. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And you know, like actually where I work, they, we have partnerships with like some of the local, boys and girls clubs and stuff in the area. Mm-hmm. So like I've gone a couple times to like girls that were like 12, 13, again, how much are they paying attention to me? I don't know. But if they can take like one little nugget of knowledge from me talking to them, then that's good. You know, that's something they can take with them. And especially, you know, in some areas, you know, especially with some cultures, there's a lot of misconceptions about how things work. So if you're hearing this stuff from your moms, your grandmothers, who are like not correct, to be completely honest, you're just going to hold that information, because who are you to question? I mean, nowadays I think it's different because you have your phone and stuff like that. But when we were growing up, like Google didn't exist. If my mom told me something or someone else told me something, I just believed it to be true. How was I to know any better? Yeah, I'm like, okay, that's
it. And then you'd pass it on down.
Exactly.
And then you tell your friend. And then you're just sharing misinformation your entire life.
I think it's
like for me, when I think I'm shooting out
multiple eggs
from both sides, just bang, 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 bang. And then I go there.
And they're like, ma'am, it's only
my doctor's side. Oh, you got your left ovary released your egg or whatever. And I'm like, excuse me, my left ovary? Thank you, left ovary. Like, I don't know. I had no idea. I'm like, yeah, girl,
that'd
you did it.
Terrifying,
right?
That would like that. Oh my god, could you imagine? We'd have like multiple kids. I mean, that's how like some animals kind of work. But like,
do they switch off? Like, do they switch off?
It's not like it's not every other. It's just random.
Oh,
so I think it was. I think maybe the left one just loves me.
If you when you go in for your early ultrasounds, we can tell because there's a cyst that's left behind. Like, if you get pregnant, there's a small cyst that's left behind on the ovary where that egg came out of, because it secretes like a hormone to help support the early pregnancy. So we can usually tell which side you got pregnant from. Yes.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm lefty. I'm a lefty over here.
I don't even know. I think I was just in such shock.
I don't remember. I don't actually remember either.
Sure.
Oh, because I don't think, unless they tell you, you're not going to know. So just like something my doctor was like, oh, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what?
It's something we just see.
And
it's
then
not,
I definitely Googled it.
Yeah. It doesn't like have any impact on the pregnancy necessarily, like which side you got pregnant from. But it's, and when you go for your ultrasound, usually we can see. Yeah. And a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, that's the ovary that did it. That's it.
Not me sitting in the car saying I'm about to have a whole ass child. I didn't even know that our ovaries release one at a time.
Like, I'm actually very unprepared for this.
You're like, can we pause this for 5 years while I go study my body for
an anatomy class? All right. Yeah. So coming after pregnancy, as you go into older age and advanced maternal age, when should you start, I guess, what is hormone therapy for starters? And then when should you start hormone therapy?
Yeah. So hormone replacement, I'm assuming you mean for like menopause, like when you're going getting to menopause and stuff. Okay. That's what I thought. So
it was a question from one of our viewers.
No, but it's a good question because there's a lot of, there used to be a lot of fear around hormone therapy. It's like, you know, if you go back like 30 years ago, every woman was on, first off, every woman got a hysterectomy and then every woman got put in hormones. That was just how those old school doctors did it. Nowadays, we don't do hysterectomies as much because unless they're needed. But there was a whole big study that came out in like the early 2000s that basically terrified a whole generation of women from not doing hormone therapy, because they saw increased risk of stroke and blood clots and heart disease and stuff like that. Now, that study was found to be not accurate because they were testing women in their like 60s, like the average age of the study was like in their 60s. Women go through menopause somewhere in the late 40s to 50s. The average age is like 51 in the US. And they've done like further studies and stuff. And they actually found that in the early part of menopause, which is when the symptoms are the worst, like when you're actively going into menopause, and menopause is no period for 12 months. I'm just going to throw that out there. So you are getting to the point where you're skipping cycles, you're skipping periods, you are having hot flashes, you are having mood swings, like a lot of irritability and stuff like that. There's a lot of the classic menopause symptoms. None of those symptoms are harmful. Like, they are not hurting your health. They're not doing anything negative to you, but they really affect your quality of life. Like, a lot of women suffer with them. And it depends on the severity. Some women get barely any symptoms and they're totally fine, but a lot of women have some symptoms. Hormone replacement therapy treats those symptoms. Okay. They actually found for women who are otherwise healthy, like, you don't have any, like, no major medical problems. Hormone replacement therapy is actually beneficial. It helps to treat the symptoms. It's very safe. And it really gives you an improvement in your quality of life. Now, a lot of people think that hormones and stuff are going to help with their, with, like, your risk of dementia and your, you know, weight loss and stuff. A lot of women notice they gain weight as you approach menopause. It doesn't help with that. It just doesn't. There's, like, a lot of mixed studies. Like, it's not, I tell people, like, you taking hormones is not going to make you lose or gain weight necessarily for, like, right, in this instance. But it can help with those symptoms I mentioned. It can sometimes help with sex drive. You know, some women get very dry down there. That's actually one of the biggest complaints I get from people, is you get a lot of vaginal dryness and it just makes intercourse painful. Like, it's dry, things get tight. And honestly, the less you use it as you get older, the tighter it gets and you don't get that back. So I always tell people, like, not if you don't use it, you lose it. But, like, if the longer you wait in between, it's not going to go back. It's never, first off, even with hormones, it's never going to go back to how it was in your 20s and 30s. Okay. It's going to be different. But I think it's important that you try some, like, there are a lot of different things you can do, because sex is important as you get older. I think it's, you know, if you have a healthy relationship or whatever, and you want to keep having sex, I think it's important to do that. I think a lot of women feel like as they get older, they feel less, especially going through menopause, you feel less feminine. You're losing that part of yourself, right? Like, you can't get pregnant anymore. You're like, that's it. That whole part of you is shutting down. You have all these other, like, things happening in your life that it's like the last thing you're thinking about is sex. But I think it's important if you want to continue having sex, then you should definitely talk to someone about it, because some people don't want to, and that's fine. You do your own thing. But I feel like I have a lot of my older patients who, like, they wish they talked to someone, because they come and see me and they're having pain and things are already pretty not great. And I tell them, like, we can try some things and it'll get better, but it's like, we're already at the point where we're, you know, it's probably always going to be uncomfortable unless you, like, really want to do, like, a lot of therapies and stuff like that. So, and I feel bad for them. Mm-hmm. But then I'm like, you know, but there are other things you can do. You don't have to have vaginal intercourse to enjoy having sex and stuff. So, like, that's a whole nother discussion I have with my cute old ladies. I love them.
I love it.
But yeah, I think hormone replacement is a really good option for the right woman. I usually tell my patients, I usually like to try to wait until, for hormones specifically, I like to wait until you are actually in menopause or you are very close to being, meaning, like, you are actively skipping a lot of periods and stuff like that.
Okay. So there are, like, warning signs, essentially.
Yeah. If you are, there's this time called perimenopause, which is like the years leading up to actually going through menopause. If you're having some symptoms then, I actually usually tell people to go on, like, a low-dose birth control pill, because that can actually help with a lot of those symptoms. Some women, and then there are non-hormone treatments for some of these, like, symptoms too, like hot flashes and stuff. They're actually non-hormone treatments to help them. So, like, that's a major cause. If you are having pain with intercourse, there are lubes and over-the-counter moisturizers for the vagina that you can use. There's vaginal estrogen, which is actually extremely safe to use. If I could give that to every woman when they turn 50, I would.
What is that?
It's a cream. It's a vaginal cream for that has a low dose of estrogen in it. And it's helps to keep the vagina moist, and it helps, sorry, I know it's a gross word, but it helps to keep the moisture in the vagina.
It's not gross when you're talking about a vagina.
It helps to keep the tissue a little more pliant, so, like, it stretches so you don't get the pain with, like, the stretching and stuff. I mean, I've talked to oncologists and stuff, and they're like, even women with breast cancer, they give this too, because it's not, they've done a ton of studies, it's not absorbed into the bloodstream. It literally only works in the vagina. So
that's cool.
If you're having pain, like, because that's the one thing, a lot of the menopause symptoms, the hot flashes, the mood, stuff like that, that tends to get better. It might take a few years, but it tends to go away. The dryness does not go away. That's the one thing that stays and gets worse. So if there's anything I think women should be proactive about, it's that as you get older.
That is good to know. Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I do not want to be the Sahara down there.
Yeah. No. I mean, I don't think anybody does. So, but it's good to know that there's things that you can do to
Dr. Farabee.
Yeah. To either prevent it or to be proactive about it.
Yeah.
I think women just need to listen to their bodies and not be ashamed to talk about it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's such this like taboo like thing about being like, hey, you know, like after I had Sage, I had weird phantom pains in my vagina. Like after, and I didn't really know what to say because it wasn't like there. And she's kind of like the doctor. But like, she listened to me and I, like, she didn't make me feel crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I feel like for so many people, they would just sit there and be like, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're literally sitting there with pain. Like, go talk to someone. It's your vagina is your
100%. A lot of people don't think it's like important, or they, you know, you're a mom and you have a million other things going on. And I mean, I'm not going to lie. Part of it is like the healthcare system, right? Like I have a 4-month wait list for people to see me. And like, I feel bad about that, but I can only see I'm a human, right? I can only see so many people in a day. I have a life, I have a family, I have kids, like I have a kid. Like I can't like,
you have your own vagina.
Yeah. Like I can't just be at your beck and call. Like everyone's beck and call for 24/7. I'm one person. So in one sense, I get it. Cause like you call for a problem and you're told like, it's going to take a month for you to see your doctor. And that's frustrating. And a lot of women are like, well, I don't know what's happening. I don't even know my life a week from now, like let alone a month from now. And, or they make that appointment and then you cancel last minute because something comes up, your kid's sick, or you can't get out of work, or like something like that. So I think it's hard. But I do think women really need to try to make a priority out of their health, and like, not all the time, like you have to squeeze it in someplace. Because when you ignore things, they can just get worse and worse. And that's just not in like your reproductive health or anything like that. Like that's everything. That's your mental health, you know, seeing a primary doctor, like really anyone in their 30s should be seeing your general doctor once a year. They do regular blood work. They make sure everything is good. I haven't gone to a primary doctor in like 2 years because like, when do I have the time to go? But I do think it's important to at least put a little bit of time, take a little bit of time out of your life. Like it's once a year, right?
Consider it like self-care almost.
Yeah. It's once a year to go see your doctor. You pay for health insurance, you know, like might as well use it a little bit.
Yeah.
So
I have the most burning question for you ever.
Yes.
And this is for everyone who has a vagina, who doesn't have a vagina, who has made comments about vaginas. This comes back to our body issue topic that we talked about before.
Okay.
Let's just inform people that all vaginas are different.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Oh, 100%.
They're all different.
I've had some young girls like come to me like asking for like a labiaplasty, like for adjustment for their labia and stuff like that. And I tell them,
they're like, labias are too big. Yeah. And it's like, they're not too big. Yeah. They're just different.
And I tell people, like, I've seen thousands of labia and vagina. Like, I promise yours isn't like so awful or something like that. I can think of one patient I have ever seen that I actually was like, yes, I think we should do surgery. And it's more because she actually had like a growth down there, but it was a point she couldn't wear pants. She couldn't wear underwear. She couldn't wear pants. You know what I mean? If you're at that point, then like, yes, absolutely. We should do something. I've had a couple young girls who tell me that like they try to wear like the really, really short shorts or like thongs and stuff. And like, they feel like it gets stuck or gets like chapped constantly. And I'm like, they wanted surgery so they could continue wearing. They're like really, really short, like, tight
maybe
stuff.
Just don't wear those
and I was
things.
Like, do you have to wear it? And they're like, I really, really want to. I did take back one girl because she was also like in her late 20s. She was so, so insistent. And she actually was super happy afterwards. She recovered great. I told her I honestly barely took anything off, but I took like a very, very little bit off and she was so happy. She was great.
Is it like a local anesthetic that you
I took her to the OR. You can do it under local, but it's, you know, it can be a lot and it's uncomfortable. So I think you take them to the operating room. It's like, it takes 5 minutes, honestly. It takes a little longer as long as you're careful and trying to make sure things are even. But, you know, yeah, I think under anesthesia is a lot nicer.
Yeah.
Well, see, the problem is that when people are watching like pretty porn or seeing pictures, there's no labia.
A lot
like,
of women have
nothing.
Had surgery. A lot of those women have actually had surgery.
Yes. And it's like, guys, labia is normal. Every vagina should look different. It might smell different than the next one.
Yeah.
Like it is literally its own little
ecosystem
down there. So it's like, I feel like social media yes. and all this stuff has like portrayed vaginas to be these little cute tiny things
yeah.
that don't smell, don't have any curtains.
No, like, it's, you know, true.
It's like, that's not true. It's so not true. Like, if you lined us all up and oh, had
everyone's
us
looks different.
Spread our yeah. legs, every single one would not look the same.
Yep.
And they shouldn't.
Yep.
But that's why the vaginas are cool, because you're getting something different with everyone. Yeah.
Boobs too. I see 100, I see thousands of them too. And like everyone, like the different mm-hmm. shapes, like nipple sizes are different, different colors, one's bigger than the other. Like, it's totally normal. It's completely mm-hmm. normal. I know. I wish
you heard it here, guys.
If people could see it from my perspective, they would understand that like there is such a range of what's considered normal.
Should we have pubes?
If you want to.
Okay. But you're not one of those, like,
there's no benefit.
No, I mean, okay, you can do whatever you want to, like, if you want to wax or anything like that. I do tell people, if you are someone who has like sensitive skin and stuff like that, like waxing is not the best, because it can cause irritation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just like skin 101, right? Like anywhere on your body. Yeah. If you are going to shave, I usually like don't use the type of razor we use like on our legs and stuff like that, because those really cause like ingrown hairs and irritation and stuff. And that's when people can get infections down there. Like, I've seen a lot of women who like shave with like not the best razor because they're doing it really quickly and they cut themselves and it turns into an infection and then I have to drain it. It's like a whole thing. So if you're going to clip your pubes, use like a clipper, like an electric clipper or something like that. And you just clip it really, really short. If you want to wax, then wax. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But use a clipper.
What? Me? I have a clipper.
Clippers are great.
Yeah.
Why did you touch me?
No, I was going to have you ask your question that I don't want to know the answer to.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Was
your question the last one, Bridge?
Yeah.
I loved it.
What's the difference between squirting and coming?
It's funny. I was talking to my husband about he like wanted to know the questions last night, and he was like, who asked that question? Ask that.
Love him.
Okay. So I think, okay, I want to clarify, actually. So by coming, do you mean orgasm?
Like yeah.
Coming. Okay. Yeah. All right. And then squirting yeah. separately. Okay. So mm-hmm. orgasm is different. That's the nerves in the clitoris or, you know, in the vagina and stuff that reach the peak. And you have that, I hate the euphoria feeling, but like that's what, you know, but that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
That's different. Some people get a spasming of muscles with it. Some people don't. Everyone's orgasms are actually a little bit different too. So keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. And every orgasm itself is different. Like mm-hmm. for you. Some people get the spasming and stuff like that. Squirting is, so there's actually some debate about squirting. Like, some people still mm-hmm. say it's not like a real thing. I think everyone knows it is a thing.
Right.
It's not pee. It's a little bit pee, but it's not only pee. Like, a lot of people say like, oh, you just peed yourself. It's not actually pee. It's, so there's glands called the skene mm-hmm. glands that are right on the outside of the urethra, right? And like, so the top of the vagina, between the top of the vagina and the urethra, mm-hmm. for some women, those glands fill up with fluid and with a powerful enough orgasm, if you get the spasming of the muscles and stuff, it can secrete out some fluid. And it comes mm-hmm. out of the urethra. So that's why there is some pee component to it, but it actually is right. mostly from those glands. Yeah.
I think that's the greatest thing I learned and today. Some people, out of everything.
So a lot of, well, everyone's different. Some women will do it every once in a while. Some people do it every time. Some people never will do it. So, and that's not, right. there's nothing wrong if you don't squirt or if you do squirt.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah.
The more you
Dr.
know.
Dr. Farah B, people.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for coming from my house.
Not squirting.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, no. Seriously, thank you so much for joining us. You are our first unbothered podcast guest.
I know.
We appreciate you.
You are our first.
Yes. Thanks for having me. And again, so I'm not everyone's doctor, but I think the biggest thing is, if you're having a problem, first off, you have to find a doctor you like. Like, with every profession, right? There are good and bad. So you might have a bad experience. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean all OBGYNs are bad. But it might take time for you to find the one that you like. But once you find one you like, go to them. Like, we want to help you. That's literally our jobs. So I think find a good doctor you like and trust and go to them.
Love it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. This was so informative. And hopefully it decreases the stigma around women's health and vaginas and just talking about it. Mm-hmm. So we really appreciate you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
And doing it during nap time. Yeah. Because you just took an hour of your time away.
No. My husband's got it. It's okay.
Seriously. Okay, perfect. All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Farabee.
Thanks, guys.
Have a great day.
Bye.